The Sunstone Foundation presents Fasting and Food, Not Weapons, A Mormon Response to Conflict, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
I'm very pleased, first of all, to introduce to you Dr. Eugene England. We were reminiscing a few minutes before we got started here, and it turns out that many years ago, in fact, eons ago, we attended the University of Utah together, and Dr. England is, I'm sure many of you know, is a founding editor of Dialogue and received his doctorate degree from Stanford University. He's the author of two books, one, Brother Brigham, and the other, Dialogues with Myself. He's a teacher of Mormon literature and American literature at Brigham Young University and is a professor there. He also teaches Shakespeare and is writing a book right now on Shakespeare and Melville, which should be an interesting combination there. His topic today is Fasting and Food, Not Weapons, A Mormon Response to Conflict. Following Dr. England, we will hear a response from Hardy Redd, who is president of LaSalle Livestock Company. Mr. Redd is a rancher. He lives in southeastern Utah in the Monticello area. He's a father of nine children, and you may have seen his name because he's served for two terms in the Utah House of Representatives. So we're very pleased to have these two gentlemen here and looking forward to their paper and comments following.
I have a text for my sermon this morning. The Lord speaking in Isaiah chapter 58. Is not this the fast that I have chosen? Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house, when thou seest the naked, that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh? And if thou draw out thy soul to the hungry, and satisfy the afflicted soul, the Lord shall guide thee continually. And thou shalt be like a watered garden, and like a spring of water, whose waters fail not. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. I wish to share with you this morning two propositions and two specific proposals, and also two images. First, the images. On May the 13th, 1981, in St. Peter's Square in Rome, I was reaching over a barrier to touch the Pope's outstretched hand as he circled through the crowd in his Pope-mobile at the beginning of his weekly public audience, when I saw the bullets hit him, one squarely in the front below the heart. Though I was momentarily stunned by the sound as well as the sight, three clear impressions came immediately. John Paul II, a man of God, is terribly hurt and will die. Poland's solidarity, to which he gave spiritual authenticity, is finished as a dominant force, and the Soviet KGB is behind it. I was right about the second and third impressions. Wrong, I give thanks about the first. The Soviets have essentially destroyed solidarity, and by what I believe was a miracle, the Pope lived. The second image comes from Christmas time, 1983. That same Pope, making his yearly visit to Rome's Rabibbia prison, turned aside to the cell of Mehmet Ali Agca, the man who had shot those bullets from behind my right ear, and visited with him alone in a corner of that bare, white-walled room for 20 minutes. He held Agca's hand, whispered to him, seemed almost to be taking his confession, reached out to take his arm. As he left, Agca lifted the Pope's hand to his forehead in the Muslim gesture of respect. The Pope later said he had told Agca he forgave him for the shooting, that he fully accepted him as a brother. A cynic might claim that such a well-publicized gesture, television crews and photographers present, was expected and merely political in intent, but he would be wrong. The gesture, in fact, surprised us all, and it has no larger political meaning unless we give it one, as we should, by recognizing that the affairs of groups and nations terrorism, war, and starvation, along with all other evils and their solutions, finally come down to the individual heart and to personal gestures of mercy. As one Italian newspaper wrote in response, in the midst of so many voices raised to ask for negotiations between the superpowers on the basis of pure equilibrium of strength, in a choir of pacifism which proclaims that only peace counts, all else is relative, a pope has the courage to utter the ancient word, the responsibility for each evil rests in man as a sinner. There will be no escape from wars, from hunger, from misery, from racial discrimination, from denial of human rights, not even from missiles, if our hearts are not changed. According to another Italian writer, Carlo Bo, quote, the pope intends to say, if we really want peace, we must take the first step. We must forgive offenses and offer the bread and love of charity, end quote. And the normally rather cynical Time magazine began its report by reviewing the complexities and difficulties of applying the principle of mercy in affairs between groups and nations, and restated our defensible need and strong impulse not to neglect the requirement that people be restrained, punished, until justice is done and change occurs. But Time then pointed out that such a course in history continually leads to more retribution until someone has the courage to break the pattern and freely forgive. Mercy, despite the danger it might undermine the protections of social justice, is actually a shrewd strategy that makes change possible when no other force seems capable. When, for instance, we have, in Time's words, implacable retributive tribes like those of Northern Ireland or Lebanon that find themselves backwatered, isolated, perishing in their own fury. Time quoted Donald Shriver, unless there is a breach with the evil past, all we get is this stuttering repetition of evil, and concluded, forgiveness is not an impulse that is much in favor. It is a mysterious and sublime idea in many ways. The prevalent style in the world runs more to the high plains drifter, to the hard, cold eye of the avenger, to a numb remorselessness. Forgiveness does not look much like a tool for survival in a bad world, but that is what it is. This same point, that unconditional love is required, will succeed in conflicts between nations as well as between neighbors, was made in even more uncompromising terms for those of Mormon Christian faith by the LDS First Presidency in their Christmas message of 1981. To all who seek a resolution to conflict, be it a misunderstanding between individuals or an international difficulty among nations, we commend the counsel of the Prince of Peace. Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. And this principle of loving one another as Jesus Christ loves us will bring peace to the individual, to the home and beyond, even to the nations and to the world. Now, with those two images in mind, the bullets piercing the white front of the Pope's vestments, and the Pope in white vestments in the bare cell of his would-be assassin, freely forgiving him, let us consider the two propositions and two specific proposals. First, I believe our primary human task, more important than arms control, because it would be the most effective means to that end, is to work to end world hunger by the year 2000. And second, I believe it is possible to do so if we unite in action across religious lines and including the increasing numbers of people who are non-religious in any traditional sense, especially including our enemies, certainly the Poles and Ethiopians, even the Chinese and Russians. This will, I'm sure you can see, require some change in perspective, some repentance from all of us. But first we need to unite on those basic propositions, and the current crisis in Africa, like the one in Poland 4 years ago, provides us an opportunity. My thesis here is very simple, though it is not really mine and not simplistic. It is that fasting regularly and giving the food saved to the hungry, especially our enemies, is the surest route to world peace as well as world health. Impelled by universal human emotions in the face of starvation, especially in the face of a crisis, we mortal sinners have shown we can unite in ways we seem unable to in other matters, even in something so basic as arms reduction. Participating in the first major fast for Ethiopia, November 10, 1984, as well as the national fast for Poland, February 24, 1982, were people with a wide range of beliefs, Jews, evangelical and liberal Christians, Mormon Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, Mohammedans. There were as well people with no specific religious belief, not believers in a personal God, but believers in life and human responsibility, people trying to make sense of life and trying to be ethically disciplined in response to that sense. This immensely diverse group of people were able to unite in both empathizing with the hungry by going without food and in giving the savings to stop the hunger. Another example, of course, is the recent Live Aid concert, which united a similarly diverse group of people around the world. And all of us, believers and non-believers, have prophets who have taught the simple and essential ideas about which a common effort to fight death, disease, and starvation can be built. The first of these is that we are all sinners and all equally responsible, not in the sense of being to blame, but in being able to do something, to act for ill or good. We are all capable of acting contrary to what we know is right. Often we do not even know what is right. None of us, therefore, can hold self-righteously aloof. Not only the Old Testament prophets and Christ taught this clearly, but so have Augustine, Luther, Freud, Marx, Dostoevsky, Camus, Eliot, Bellow, and other great writers and thinkers, whether Stoic, non-believer, or theist, believer. For us who accept Spencer W. Kimball as a prophet, the teaching has been particularly direct and sobering. This is his judgment on Americans, particularly his fellow Mormons, at the time of our self-congratulation at our bicentennial in 1976. Quote, "We are, on the whole, an idolatrous people, a condition most repugnant to the Lord. We are a warlike people, easily distracted from our assignment of preparing for the coming of the Lord. When enemies rise up, we commit vast resources to the fabrication of gods of stone and steel, ships, planes, missiles, fortifications, and depend on them for protection and deliverance. When threatened, we become anti-enemy instead of pro-kingdom of God. We train a man in the art of war and call him a patriot, thus in the manner of Satan's counterfeit of true patriotism, perverting the Savior's teaching that we love our enemies. We forget that if we are righteous, the Lord will either not suffer our enemies to come upon us, or he will fight our battles for us." End of quote. But few of us listen to our prophets when they point to our universal sinfulness. Perhaps we could listen better to their universally consistent solution to that sinfulness. Every great religious and philosophical tradition has reiterated one central principle for opposing human evil, that is, helpfulness and mercy instead of rejection and vengeance, humble sacrificial love instead of pride and selfishness. The Old Testament prophet Micah says it this way, "He hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of thee? But to do justice, justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God." The New Testament is even more clear and challenging. Just before he was crucified, Christ taught his apostles the one basic criterion of acceptance by him, the one that would separate his sheep from the goats when he came again in glory. "For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me." In teaching this same fundamental principle, the Book of Mormon prophet Benjamin emphasizes two ideas that I believe would particularly help to end world hunger. One, that mercy cannot in any sense be judgmental or reserved or even discriminating. And second, that mercy is essential for the salvation of the giver as well as the receiver. He instructs a group of newly converted Christians, quote, "Ye yourselves will succor those that stand in need of your succor. You will administer your substance unto him that standeth in need, and you will not suffer that the beggar putteth up his petition to you in vain and turn him out to perish. Perhaps thou shalt say, the man has brought upon himself his misery, therefore I will stay my hand, for his punishments are just. But I say unto you, O man, whosoever doeth this, except he repenteth of that which he hath done, he perisheth forever, and hath no interest in the kingdom of God. For behold, are we not all beggars? Do we not all depend upon the same being, even God, for all the substance which we have, for both food and raiment, and for gold and for silver, and for all the riches which we have of every kind? And if you judge the man who putteth up his petition to you for your substance that he perish not, and condemn him, how much more just will be your condemnation for withholding your substance, which doth not belong to you but to God." This point, that we must give without judgment, is precisely relevant to the current crisis in Ethiopia, where the communist regime has apparently brought on at least some of the problem through centralized economic planning and imposed land reform, and whose government, where the government is responding in ways that look politically motivated. Should we stay our hand, as many in our country have demanded, because their punishments are just? In December 1981, when martial law was imposed on Poland by a government which seemed to have brought suffering and economic chaos to its people through communist economic controls and subservience to Russia, were we right to respond by cutting off all our government aid and cooperation of various kinds? I think not. And what do our acts of mercy towards others, feeding the starving, aiding the sick who do not deserve it, have to do with our own salvation? According to Benjamin, for the sake of retaining a remission of your sins from day to day, that you may walk guiltless before God, I would that you should impart of your substance to the poor, every man according to that which he hath, such as feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting the sick, and administering to their relief, both spiritually and temporally, according to their wants. That same wisdom echoes through all great literature and all revered examples of ideal human response. Shakespeare's Portia in The Merchant of Venice reminds us that, quote, in justice, none of us would see salvation, and that mercy, quote, blesseth him that gives and him that takes. Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who persists against incredible odds in helping the starving and dying in that city street, has been called inefficient, since she cannot begin to keep up with the growing misery around her as the population increases. Her critics claim that what is needed is a massive, rationally efficient government program. She continues to define poverty not as a lack of resources, but as a lack of love, and she does not feel that her work is futile if she can do no more than offer a few dying people a chance to die, quote, within sight of a loving face. Seeing that mercy is more important than efficiency, both for the receiver and for the giver, she achieves the greatest efficiency that exists in Calcutta because she is one who is doing something. She teaches her helpers that prayer and meditation are important preparation, but that finally they must renounce personal luxury and commit themselves to uncalculated giving. She knows what John taught him in the New Testament, quote, but whoso hath this world's goods, and seeth his brother have need, and shutteth up the bowels of compassion from him, how swelleth the love of God in him? My little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Brigham Young also understood this. During the October 1956 church conference in Salt Lake City, when he heard of the Willie and Martin Handcart Company's plight in the snow of Wyoming, he dismissed the conference to go to their aid by saying, prayer is good, but when baked potatoes and milk are needed, prayer will not suffice. A central part of the dream Martin Luther King called us to share was that prayer and pious hopes alone were not enough to bring social justice, but the direct action towards civil rights, the shared goal of civil rights, could help bring spiritual salvation to both blacks and whites. If all our various religious and non-religious philosophical traditions teach us what to do about human need and human conflict and why, the remaining question is how to do it. There are some examples before us. Oxfam, one of the main sponsors for the November 1984 fast for Ethiopia, was founded at Oxford University in 1942 by students. It slowly grew and expanded, and a branch came to America in 1970. In 1983, Oxfam America raised about $5.6 million, which is a pittance compared to the need, but something. So perhaps we should think a few minutes about the scale of need and resources available. Robert A. Evans, in his recent book about the world problems that need to be solved, has expressed the popular image of a global village in concrete, specific terms. Quote, if the world were a village of 100 persons, one-third would be rich or moderate income, and two-thirds would be poor. About 35 would suffer from hunger and malnutrition. At least half would be homeless or living in inadequate housing. In the village, 47 would be unable to read and write, and only one would have a college education. 6 of the 100 would be Americans and would have over one-third of the village's entire income, whereas the other 94 would subsist on the remaining two-thirds. The Americans would produce 16% of the village's food supply and consume most of it themselves, except that they would store for future use or even destroy to raise its value in the village market. Over half of the remaining 94 would be hungry most of the time and would consider the six to be enormously wealthy and disproportionately well-fed, with three of them on a diet. Of the 94, 42 would eventually die of diseases such as malaria or cholera. About 15 would die of starvation within a year. 10 of these would be children. Perhaps the central implication of this image is that those of us, probably all who are here in this room today, who are among the world's most privileged 5 or 6%, should try to imagine how our suffering and dying neighbors, the desperate parents of diseased and hungry children, might perceive us if we really were their next-door neighbors. We could thus understand the judgments of the world upon us. Distance and borders cannot provide moral immunity, especially if we believe, as Mormons do, that we made specific covenants in the great councils in heaven before we came to this world, promising that if we turned out to be among the more fortunate in a mortal probation of chance and agency, we would give our maximum effort to bring salvation to the less fortunate, whether through missionary work, temple work for the dead, or feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting the sick and imprisoned. But if we simply believe in human brotherhood, that all men and women are of one family, with filial obligations as deep as our genetic makeup, we will find a way to share our good fortune, most of it undeserved, and to reduce the pain and hatred and danger that differences naturally cause. As a specific and personal answer to the question of how, I was involved in the founding of Food for Poland in the fall of 1981. Let me not take time to discuss that, except to mention that through a combined effort involving many here in Utah, some of you in this audience, we helped send about $7 million worth of supplies to Poland during that dark winter. Received very great cooperation and help from the LDS Church, sponsored a National Day of Fasting, and so forth. And I merely wanted then to review with you what we learned in that first 6 months. At some significant cost, personally, to many of us. We learned, for instance, that using government surplus milk, we could translate a $1 donation into 20 gallons of milk delivered in Poland, enough to feed 10 children for a week. In good conscience, I could tell students that a $10 movie date, as opposed to free international films at BYU, for instance, meant 200 children without milk for a week. A similar claim could be made right now about Ethiopia. A $10 movie date foregone could mean feeding 200 children for a week in Ethiopia. Furthermore, such things as slightly outdated but still perfectly good medical supplies, clothes, books, and current medical journals, without which the Western-based Polish medical profession was quickly losing ground, many such things could do immense good if we could spend a little effort and get them to the right place. I learned that if one inept, frightened, absent-minded, and inefficient professor of English could make a pitifully small but real contribution, so could many with greater talent. I talked to people almost every day who could give thousands of dollars, even millions, and never miss it, but would not. I got letters from families who fasted regularly and sent us their savings to the penny, and some who sent donations for a while and then stopped when publicity stopped. I also learned how governments can help and hinder. In the summer of 1982, just after we received our largest total of cash contributions, we found ourselves cut off from the purchase of further surplus milk by the expiration of the earlier allowance. The current administration had centered its policy on Poland around the reprisals imposed by President Reagan in response to Jaruzelski's martial law. We worked with the Department of Agriculture, aided by Utah Senators Garn and Hatch, to initiate new allotments of surplus milk. Finally, after much effort, we received permission for a million-pound shipment in 1984. But in the process, I became convinced that our little effort did more to promote peace than all the government's reprisals. In fact, if our government, I believe, in 1980 and 81, had had the courage and fundamental Christian goodwill to give Poland $1 billion in a well-planned, marshaled-planned type of rebuilding program, with no political strings attached that would have aroused the Soviets, I believe that action just might have made the survival of solidarity possible. Instead, our government cut off almost that much in loans and commodities, including feed for the huge chicken industry that it had encouraged and then helped destroy. Shakespeare's Portia was right. In justice, none of us shall see salvation. Withdrawing help, using food as a weapon of retribution, will not bring peace or freedom or stability to Poland. That can be done only by mercy and sacrifice, a willingness to live with and help a basically socialist system that will remain so and that must remain unthreatening in its foreign policy to Russia. We could still achieve that if we could move our government to give massive apolitical, technical, and material help as relations between our countries begin to thaw. But that requires public willingness to help or even to love an enemy, something we must still learn to do, even if we say as Christians that we believe in it. That is why I believe in a goal of solving world hunger, which would require cooperating with, even giving to, our avowed enemies, just as we are now being asked to do in Ethiopia. If we cannot do that, then I see no way we can eventually solve that much more touchy problem of arms control with those same enemies. Let me then find two simple, if rather dramatic, proposals. But first I will make one that is too dramatic, probably impossible. Get the United States and Russia each to give half their arms budget to meet the Third World's basic needs. It's been calculated that the nearly $500 billion per year that made available would provide resources for all the needs, food, health, education, even housing, of the poorer countries. If we would join our power and resources to these ends, we would learn to be friends with the Soviets and might also learn that we could do just fine without the other half of those arms. But most of us object, we would do it if they would, but they can't be trusted. All right, if we're unwilling to risk unilateral action because we really don't believe Christ and President Kimball when they say that loving our enemies would bring response, then let me suggest, as my first serious proposal, a perfectly safe move. Our finest experts cannot agree within 10 to 20% about just what arms budget is really necessary to our national security. There would certainly be no risk if we dedicated a mere 5% of that budget to peace. With that 5%, which would be over $20 billion, even if the Russians would not respond in kind, though I believe they would, we could provide $10,000 per person to send 1 million of our young students and young professionals each year to live and study in Russia, to learn their language and to understand and appreciate their culture and their political and moral perspective. And that same 5% would also pay for 1 million of their young people to live in America and learn the same thing. In 20 years, 10% of our respective populations would know each other as something other than the dangerous propaganda caricatures we are to each other now. And if nothing else, the presence of 1 million of our best young minds in Russia and of theirs here might help deter both sides from nuclear attack. We constantly use our immense resources instead for the more direct, the easy solution of force, which usually doesn't work at all and certainly never provides a lasting solution. We strike at the branches of evil, but never at the root. There are many things I don't know with certainty. I don't know if a nuclear freeze would work, would make peace more secure rather than less. I'm not absolutely certain spending 5% of our arms budget for exchange of students would build love or merely confirm our suspicions and hatred of each other. I'm not even completely sure that feeding the poor together, especially those who are enemies, would allay the centuries-old antagonisms and suspicions that preserve the arms race. But I firmly believe these are our best chances and deserve a try. We have tried the other ways: recriminations, reprisals, name-calling, infantile line-in-the-sand braggadocio, all the machinations of justice and vengeance, none of which are endorsed by Christ nor any of the great religious or secular prophets and thinkers of history, and none of them has worked. On the other hand, the only major international effort in our century that could be defended as mainly consistent with Christian principles, the Marshall Plan, worked magnificently. The things of the world as ends in themselves, to leave off idolatry and press forward in faith, to carry the gospel to our enemies, that they might no longer be our enemies. The logic is rationally and historically irresistible. The only way permanently to do away with enemies, defeating, suppressing, even killing them, has never succeeded, is to turn them into friends through Christ's gospel, that is, through the natural laws of merciful giving and forgiving. Our church leaders have set the example for us, and it is for us, with our agency, to do what they, given the limitations of their specific stewardship, apparently cannot do or direct us to do, that is, to initiate, organize, create the mechanisms for solving world hunger, for leading our government into paths of thought and action that will support that goal and move our enemies to join with us, whether they do it through shame in the face of world opinion or genuine human response. Despite the feeling and public allegation of some Utahns that we founders of Food for Poland were traitors, giving aid to an enemy in time of war, the church gave over $100,000 in welfare supplies for Polish aid in 1982 and is continuing that aid to the present. Despite the claim of some Utahns that the Ethiopian communists deserve their fate, the church called for a day of fasting in the United States and Canada on January the 27th, 1985, the proceeds going to African Relief, and leaders in England and elsewhere around the world followed up with very successful fasts in their areas. I understand between $5 and $6 million were raised. Think if we could do that each month, and we could, I think, without any serious sacrifice, we could each year, merely as a church, produce as much as the much ballyhooed and properly publicized live aid effort. Conservatives who have emphasized obedience can now, through this kind of mechanism, show their sincerity by enthusiastically following an example they might not readily have chosen. Liberals who have called for more direct church action in social need can now put their money where their mouths have been. But all of us, in order to sustain our efforts into the areas of individual creativity that will solve the problem, must come to believe with emotional conviction what our scriptures remind us is true. God has made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth. Whether we believe the prophets or the biologists, we are one blood. The withered, fetus-like child staring out its last minutes of life in a Red Cross camp in northern Ethiopia, and her desperate parents who walked 100 miles to bring her there for help, have their claim upon us. Finally, I believe the most immediate way to feel that unity of blood and some of the shared pain that might move us to do something is literally to fast, to go without food and water until we know directly how close we all are to death if our sustenance is cut off. And regular fasting, and in the custom of the Mormon tradition, giving the money saved to feed others, seems to me the most direct way both of solving world hunger and of building human empathy to the point of solving other problems. Suppose that once a week, the 100 million Americans who are overfed, for whom diets and reducing would improve their health, and many of whom are even spending money to reduce the fat they have spent money to gain, would simply fast for 2 meals and give $10 to a famine relief. That $1 billion per week thus raised, used with only average intelligence and effectiveness, would solve the major problem of starvation in the world. And if we could get others, beginning in Europe, then Russia, then the fortunate in the needy countries themselves, up to that one-third of the global village who have more than they need, to follow our example, an example, I believe, is the one motivating force that would work, we could move on to long-term economic improvement and the solution of other problems such as health and housing and education. Fasting has an intrinsic power that can expand our vision and action into other areas, into dealing with political oppression and competition, even, I believe, into confronting the fearsomely competitive arms races of the world. Listen again to Isaiah, who spoke the Lord's condemnation of ceremonial long-faced fasting and his description of the only fasting that is acceptable. Is not this the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke? Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house? When thou seest the naked, that thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh. I believe this refers to our tendency not only to hide ourselves from the immediate families in which we live, but also to cut ourselves off from the larger human family, from the one blood and flesh we are all part of, according to Paul and the biologists. We need to fast so starvation can end in Ethiopia and all over the world. We need to fast so we can develop the empathy and motivation to become one flesh with others, even with Ethiopian and Polish and Russian communists, so that there can be some genuine basis for the trust necessary to end the arms race. We need to fast so that we can retain a remission of our own sins, as King Benjamin taught, by learning mercy, by changing ourselves so we do not add to the world's evil through seeking mere justice, retribution, or through mere neglect. The Lord is clear in his promises about what will follow a true fasting of the kind he has called for. He describes in Isaiah our late century plight, by prophecy, I believe, but also a way through it. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee. Then shalt thou call, and the Lord shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, Here I am. If thou take away the putting forth of the finger and speaking vanity, and if you draw out thy soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness be as the noonday. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. In these verses, the Lord has drawn a straight line from fasting for the hungry to repairing the breach between us and Russia, to preserving peace that will raise up the foundations of many generations instead of dooming those generations in nuclear destruction. The Lord is describing with the extra power of poetic language a precise and inexorable moral law. Mercy begets and multiplies mercy. Sacrificial giving will beget and multiply kindness, understanding, patience, brotherhood, even between enemies. We have all seen and can understand a corollary moral law, that force and vengeance and destruction beget force and vengeance and destruction. There is a straight line from the My Lai massacre, where frightened, exasperated, battle-weary American soldiers killed Vietnamese women and children in 1969, to the wholesale slaughter of Cambodian educated and urban classes by Pol Pot's rural communist revolutionaries in 1975, and the slaughter of those revolutionaries in turn by Vietnamese invaders in 1979. That same moral line goes from the Blitz of London in 1940 to the destruction of Berlin in 1944, from the vicious bombing of Coventry civilians and cathedral to the even more vicious and unnecessary demolition of Dresden, of 130,000 of its people and all its churches in 1945, from Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima to the enduring, peace-threatening fear in the Russians and Chinese that we might drop nuclear bombs on them at any time. Because we have before. We have seen again and again the Lord's promise fulfilled, that they that sow the wind shall reap the whirlwind. Can we not exercise a particle of faith in his equally infallible promise that they that cast their bread upon the waters will find it returned after many days? That promise and the associated penalty were pronounced again in these latter days. In the Doctrine and Covenants, section 104, the Lord makes perfectly clear that he has provided a way for us to do away with hunger and want, but that it must be done in his own way. That is, quote, that the poor shall be exalted in that the rich are made low, not by taxation or force, but through our own irresistible moral conviction. For the earth is full, and there is enough and to spare. Yea, I prepared all things and have given unto the children of men to be agents unto themselves. Thank you.
When we started out, I felt right at home because it was just about like the branch at LaSalle, the number of people. But we've increased a little bit. Maybe we ought to be divided. I really feel uncomfortable in this position because in many ways I don't belong here. But I'm like the horse that was entered in the Kentucky Derby and came in a few minutes after all the rest had gone by, and his owner said, well, I knew he couldn't win, but I wanted him to get lathered up in good company. I followed Eugene England for a long, long time, from the time he helped start Dialogue, and I read his articles in Dialogue, and I've grown to love him. I felt like in the things that he writes, he really speaks to me. Like Mother Teresa, he not only sees a problem, he does something about it. And I think even though he admits that he may do it inefficiently and make mistakes, I have to admire and love somebody who actually does something, who takes some risk with his life and with his time. Gene's pointed out a vision here today that all of us maybe glimpse once in a while, but I think he showed us a vision, and I think we ought to grasp it. I would point out that, like most visionaries, sometimes the visions don't come to pass, or there are some impediments and problems. I think sometimes Gene's heart rules his head. And I'm going to proceed with pointing out some of the difficulties of some of the things that he mentioned. I have to mention parenthetically that I catch echoes of my father in Gene. My father used to call up the professors in animal science and range science at Utah State and BYU, and he would say, "Don't tell me why I can't do this. Tell me how I can do it." And I think Gene is telling us, let's do something, even though there are a lot of problems. I agree with Gene's idea that one of the things we Mormons could do in Zion is fast and give our money to feed the poor. This is a good idea, something we could do now. There are some impediments, and I think he recognizes these. There is a great deal of waste in distribution and storage of food. There's a problem about what do we do, whether or not the food gets to the people it's intended for. There's a problem of the education of individuals. I think China has looked at this, and I'm not sure we're ready quite among the Mormons to deal with this problem, but what happens if by feeding people we encourage them to breed so fast that they outrun even what we can give them? I think this problem needs to be addressed. Finally, a problem that needs to be addressed is what happens if we ultimately create a dependence among those people by giving them food and not teaching them how to grow their own food. I agree with Gene, at least he quoted Time magazine with approval, that ultimately what has to be done is that our hearts need to be changed. I would point out that this is a long process, and that all hearts have to be changed. The Soviet heart has to be changed. The dictators of the right and the left, the conservatives and the liberals. And I have to quake a little bit, because even in my, here I am, a Mormon Christian, supposedly that has all this knowledge, and yet in my own personal life I find it very difficult to completely forgive and forget a person who has deeply offended me. In other words, I'm saying this is going to be a tough battle. One of the thoughts that kept crossing my mind as I read this paper at the mention of Ethiopia and of Poland is the term Afghanistanism. Apparently that's a journalistic term that was used by editors of small weekly local papers, that when they couldn't deal or didn't want to deal with the problems in their own community because they were very intractable or they might offend somebody, they would write an editorial about Afghanistan. That was before Russia invaded Afghanistan. Afghanistan was far enough away that it could be pictured either black or white, and it was very easy to solve their problems because they were so distant. One of the concerns I have, and I think maybe fasting gets at part of this problem, is that we have a lot of problems here. We have disease and death and poverty along the Wasatch Front. There's child abuse, divorce, drug use. Parents are alienated in some ways from their children. Maybe one of the things that we ought to do while we're fasting, and maybe fasting will help, is repent and do the important work within the walls of our own home. I was touched by Sharon Swenson's response to the film The Godmakers, which she criticized. But the one thing she said I really felt was true was the young mother, or the young woman, in the film who said, when I go to church, I come away asking, where's the love? Why is it that this young woman said that, and why is it that Sharon Swenson felt touched by that? I could spend some time nitpicking with some of the things that Gene talks about, peace, and about trust, and about the Russians. And I don't think there's time, and I really don't want to go into it. I would just say parenthetically that for those young people in the Book of Mormon who decided not to fight, I think were very lucky in that they had some people to fight for them. And with all our hate of nuclear war and weapons, I'm grateful that there was a bulldog Hitler, a bulldog Churchill, who fought during the wilderness years to arm England. And I wonder what would have happened if Chamberlain had resisted Hitler a little earlier and a little more forcefully. I wonder if Anne Frank would be alive today. It's easy to say we want peace and to cry peace, but it's difficult to get there. I'm delighted, finally, with Gene's proposal that we exchange people between us and Russia. I think he ought to propose it now, and to the State Department and to the President. And if he doesn't want to do it, I'll do it. I think that's a delightful idea. I think it's a delightful idea to reduce the Pentagon budget by 5%. I'd like to see it reduced 20%. I think the PXs, the pension systems, are all very wrong. I would point out you might have some difficulty. I was in the legislature, and I think President Carter suggested that they eliminate some military bases, one of which was Fort Douglas. Now, if there's any military base that has since ceased to serve its function at Fort Douglas, and yet some of the legislators, and they passed a resolution over my objection, a great resolution about how important it was to keep Fort Douglas. I wonder what would happen if we would propose to eliminate the Dugway Proving Ground for Hill Air Force Base. We might do that, and that's a logical extension of President Kimball's statement. I would agree that we should start small. We should fast. I think we should grow more food. I've been intrigued by a comment by Jonathan Swift, and he gave it for his opinion that whoever could make two ears of corn or two blades of grass grow upon a spot of ground where only one grew before would deserve better of mankind and do more essential service to his country than the whole race of politicians put together. Finally, I have another suggestion. After we get to fasting and contributing this money, I think there's another sacrifice we could make. I'd like to propose, as a modest proposal echoing Jonathan Swift, that we give up one football season at BYU. I think many people would agree if there's anything frivolous in our society, it's intercollegiate athletics and football. Just think how much money, Gene, we could raise if all the money that was spent on training, and salaries, and grants and aid, and utilities, and travel, and tickets were contributed just for one season to help the poor. I'm hopeful that that's a sacrifice that later on we'll be able to make. Thank you.
I really like that last proposal. I'm all for it as long as it isn't this year. I really don't need to respond to Brother Ed. I think that my paper includes for all of you what I would say in response. Let me just emphasize two things in response to the very real questions he's raised that if we're serious about this, we are going to have to face. There's certainly have been and remain and always will be serious difficulties in trying to get food to the people who need it. People that I trust have computed the world's output of food and compared it to the need, and without producing any more food at all, that is more than we are presently producing, there is more than enough food, as the Lord said in the 104th section, to feed people a more than adequate diet right now. Right now, it isn't a problem right now of increasing food production. It's a problem of distribution, getting it where it needs to be. And there are great problems, political inefficiency, so forth. The thing I can't resist, though, is the hard doctrine of the Book of Mormon, which I think each of us must face. And I mean each of us. No one is exempt from the condemnation, because as I walk down the street in London and I'm confronted every 10 feet by someone who asks me for money, I have to face this question. And each of us find our way of answering the question. But the doctrine seems to me absolutely clear. The Book of Mormon says you take the worst possible case, that is, suppose that whatever you give will be absolutely wasted. If you know that that person is going to take that money and waste it, you still must give it, because you are in no position to make that judgment. The Book of Mormon says those kinds of realities in the world, the fact that people will misuse and waste and misdirect and so forth, the effort you make, does not reduce your responsibilities, it increases it. I think the implication is, in that kind of situation, your first responsibility is to give, then, but your responsibility doesn't end there to say, well, now I've done what the Book of Mormon says. I think clearly the implication, if you look at the whole book, is then you do all you can to build structures, to teach, and to do whatever it takes to make sure that it isn't wasted. But you don't say, well, when somebody else has done that, or when I've succeeded in developing a perfect distribution system, or making everybody capable of using the food I give them, then I'll start giving. No. First we give, then we try to solve these other problems, as I understand the Book of Mormon. The other thing I guess I would say is, we always face the question of, well, and I agree, I'm glad there was a Churchill, and Chamberlain's way certainly would have led to even greater horrors, I'm convinced. But we don't go back to the next step. What if someone at the end of World War I had been thinking in terms of mercy, and instead of being retributive towards Germany, had at that stage said, now we'll engage in a Marshall Plan to rebuild Germany? There would have been no Hitler. It was too late in 1936 to start thinking about mercy. But if we'd thought of mercy in 1919, then we wouldn't have had World War II, I'm convinced. So we can always see a point at which it seems to become too late for mercy, although I think the principle still holds. There are ways to continue to use mercy. And though I think I am as grateful as anyone else for Churchill, and for the effort that was made to stem that irrational horror and evil of Nazism, I think we again made the same mistake. That if, rather than being concerned when we began to win about retribution and unconditional surrender and punishment and bombing Dresden and bombing Hiroshima, I think in good part out of a kind of vindictiveness rather than any rational effort to bring a resolution to that great human crisis. We could have ended that war, spirit that would have not brought the whirlwind that continues since then. I really believe that. So it isn't easy, and I'm not suggesting it is, but I believe we've got to start with basic principles. Well, we've got time for questions from you for a few minutes. Any of you have? Yes. Yes, it is functioning. It's because of the difficulty of raising funds from the public when there's so little publicity, we found. We have, because we were able to raise a good amount of money at that time and have it available to convert to U.S. milk, as we've been able now to get the government to agree to sell it to us, we have now are continuing shipments to Poland. And because of the church's interest in, for a variety of reasons, including building good relations with the Polish government, that they have continued to provide help for food for Poland. We're now thinking of changing our direction a little bit and our title to go with that, perhaps into Food for Peace, and begin to involve ourselves in Africa and perhaps implement some of these ideas.
Why?
Well, historically, it comes from the fact that for a long time we were isolated and it was a real struggle just to survive ourselves, and I think we've built up an almost racial memory that is somewhat enclosed that way. And I think it's just unfortunate. But I think we have some powerful tools to change it, and you're the one who is. And I would just commend you and say, keep it up. And I think we should take full advantage of what the church leadership is doing. For a long time, we struggled without that dramatic example, though we had the scriptures and certainly some things from our own history. In the last few years, we have some marvelous authority to back up our preaching, and I think we can talk very strongly, and even if we're able to do it without being self-righteous, to call people to repentance, because the example and the implied requirement of the church leadership is there, and I think we can use it. So I would say continue to teach, help. I don't think there's any easy explanation. Again, we're all sinners and selfish, and the human experience is very often that as we get enough to help, that's precisely when we become most unwilling to. We hold on to what we have, and the people who unfortunately find it easiest to talk about it, and sometimes the interesting thing is the ones who are most willing to give are the ones who have least. But we've seen that throughout the Book of Mormon, so I think that'll always be a problem.
Thank you very much for your attention. Let's give a round of applause to these excellent presentations.